I am Bob Gutman. I'm the founder and director of the Center on Politics and Foreign Relations, which is putting on this event today. I started the center last year with a senator named John Kerry, who was a leading candidate to be president, and he spoke here, and about 2 weeks later, he decided not to run. So hope this is not like being on the cover of Sports Illustrated being negative. But anyway, we have a popular candidate now. So I just wanted to say we're having, through the next few months, we'll be having other presidential candidates, presidential advisors, journalists. We're having Senator Joe Lieberman in about a month. He's not a candidate, but he was. We're going to have Barack Obama. We're going to have Mitt Romney. We're going to be having all the other candidates. So stay tuned to our website, and we'll let you know who's coming. Today, we're very pleased to have Republican presidential candidate, congressman and doctor, medical doctor, Ron Paul as our speaker. As I was saying to the congressman, usually when we send out invitations, people write, yes, we will attend. I must say he has a hard core of followers. People say, yes, I will attend, and then tell you in 20, you know, 50 lines why they like Ron Paul. So I've been very surprised.
Thank you.
So it seems to be a phenomenon out there that's kind of breaking through. He did well in the Maryland straw poll. He's done well in other straw polls. He is a medical doctor who represents the 14th Congressional District in Texas. He's a libertarian, devoted fan of the Constitution. He stands out at the Republican debates, if you've watched them, for his outspoken comments against the war in Iraq and against American involvement abroad. Congressman Paul is a member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee and also an author. Although I went to four bookstores yesterday and couldn't find your new book, so you need to get a better distributor. I was going to hold it up here today.
It's been sold out.
So his book is out. And I also want to say I watched him last night on Bill O'Reilly. And unlike Bill O'Reilly, Bill O'Reilly didn't seem very fair or very balanced. So we will not interrupt his speech. He will get to speak for the full allotted time, and I will not interrupt him. And then we'll take questions from the audience. So ladies and gentlemen, presidential candidate for 2008, Ron Paul.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's very nice to be here. And it will be much different than last night. It's a real delight to be able to at least talk about the views and not be interrupted. But I understand if I give a 15, 20-minute talk, something like that, then we will be taking some questions. I have to apologize a little bit because I'm probably going to run to the door shortly after that because I have an airplane to catch. But this is, to me, a very important subject. I was delighted to get the invitation because it's probably the most important issue going on in this campaign right now, and that has to do with foreign policy. But it's always been an important issue, sometimes more so than others. Unfortunately, it becomes important after we get into a war that is lasting too long, and it looks like we have dug a hole for ourselves, and it seems to be endless, and then the people seem to get interested after it becomes very expensive and a lot of people die. Of course, my idea over the years has been always to try to prevent this kind of problem from emerging. And I am very much aware of what has happened in my lifetime because I do remember World War II, and I remember that war was declared, and I remember it didn't last nearly as long as what's going on now or as long as Vietnam. And it makes one wonder, why is that the case? And I've come to the conclusion that we get bogged down in no-win wars because we go to war for the wrong reasons. I think that's the real problem. We haven't declared war since World War II. We haven't really won a war since then. Yet a lot of killing's been going on, and we've spent a lot of money. And very simply, if we have the rule of law, we should only go to war according to what the law says. And the law says that only Congress can declare war. The president doesn't have the authority to do this. Vietnam, there was no declared war. In Korea, we went to war under UN resolution. That's a sacrifice of U.S. sovereignty at the same time. It's an undeclared war. And, of course, we still have troops in Korea. And it was a disaster in Vietnam. 60,000 Americans were killed, and probably during that period of time, more than a million, some people even estimate 2 million Vietnamese were killed. And yet today, we have a totally different attitude toward Vietnam. It more follows what was advised by the founders of this country, and it goes more along with our Constitution for non-intervention. We not only talk to the Vietnamese, we trade with the Vietnamese. The president of Vietnam comes here and visits, and we invest money over there, and we're not on the verge at all of being in conflict with the Vietnamese. So after all those years of killing and fighting for us to impose our will on them, it didn't work. But now, after having left, even though there was a tough transition period, now we finally get back to a more sensible relationship with the country, and we do quite well. So the quicker we accept this idea that non-intervention is much better than us assuming this moral superiority that we know how to run the world and take care of other countries and impose our will, I think the better off we will be. And in many ways, we have several choices in our foreign policy. The one that we have today is the foreign policy of empire. We're now in... We have 700 military establishments around the world. We're in 130 countries, and we're bankrupting our nation because of this maintenance. And we're literally a lot less secure because of it. There's no doubt in my mind, nor is there doubt in the minds of many, many others, that the main reason why we are threatened by outsiders coming in here and wanting to kill us is because of our foreign policy. It's not because we're free and prosperous. There are other countries that are free and prosperous, and they're not attacked. If we never address that and we don't come down to the correct conclusion, we're not going to solve this problem. It's going to last forever as long as we feel that we have this moral right to impose ourselves around the world. There were many who were hopeful after the breakdown of the end of the Cold War and the breakdown of the Soviet system that, we would cut back, we would have less money to spend on armaments, and we could come home, so to speak. But none of that happened. It seemed like there was a need to have another enemy. You know, we had to have an excuse, had to have another excuse to keep the military-industrial complex going. You know, the Eisenhower had warned us about the military-industrial complex, but our first president, Washington, warned us of the same thing. He warned us about a military establishment, a permanent military establishment, which would be a threat to our liberties. This was our first president, and then Eisenhower more recently said, don't do it. It's not good. And here we are in the midst of another war, and probably the most serious consequence, although financially it's a serious consequence, the most serious consequence of a war mentality is a threat to personal liberty. That is the biggest threat that we have to be concerned with. Randolph Bourne was absolutely right when he said war is the health of the state. If you believe in liberty, if you believe in freedom, and you want your personal liberty, you have to be opposed to unnecessary war. Defensive war, that is one thing. But unnecessary provoking of other countries is something else. The one thing that has bothered me most about what has gone on recently has been the fact that we as a nation this time invaded a country that was no threat to us whatsoever. We invaded that country. This was a preemptive war. We've been involved before, and in a way that we shouldn't have. I mean, Vietnam didn't threaten us, but there was a war going on, and we picked sides, and we went in. Korea was the same thing. Our CIA has been involved numerous times, and of course, one of the worst episodes of our CIA being involved is currently a big problem to us, and that's dealing with Iran. But this is different in Iraq. This was a planned invasion and occupation of a country that had no weapons whatsoever that they could deal with us. They never threatened us in any way whatsoever. And it was also one of the reasons this power was given to the president, this authority, was to enforce UN resolutions. So this to me is a dramatic shift from even the interventions that we've had throughout the 20th century, but much more so. And we, as a country, now face a serious problems because of it. There's no practical benefit to a policy of foreign intervention. The benefits aren't there. It is said that we need to do it. Sometimes we have to be in the Middle East. We have to protect our oil. Well, that's not a logical conclusion. That's part of the old mercantilistic ideas of protecting natural resources, that you have to own them and connect them. That's why you have to have colonial powers. This is neo-colonialism, the fact that we think that we have to have troops in the Middle East to protect our oil, which we've been told, especially before we went into the Persian Gulf War, we had to protect our oil. The war we're in now is actually a continuation of that war, the Persian Gulf War. And, of course, that was perpetual. It never ended. And the bombing continued. The sanctions continued, killed millions of Iraqis. And we had a military base in Saudi Arabia. We picked sides in the Iranian-Palestinian conflict. And these were reasons listed by those who were willing to commit suicide terrorism. The three major things: we were perceived as being anti-Palestinian. We were perceived to be in violation of all their religious beliefs by having military troops in their holy land of Saudi Arabia. At the same time, we were continuing the bombing and the destruction and the sanctions that caused the killing in Iraq. People said, when I bring this up, they say, well, yes, how can you say that occupation in Iraq is going to motivate suicide terrorism? But we've been involved for a long, long time, especially since the 1990s. But we've been involved even before that, and that has to do with Iran. In 1953, our CIA participated in the overthrow of Mossadegh, who was an elected president of Iran. So there's a country that wants democracy, is moving in that direction, so what do? We throw them out with our CIA, with the help of the British, and we put in a militant dictator who was, who the religious folks in Iran objected to, and there was a reaction. Immediate? No, it took a while. But they didn't forget 1953, but that resentment really burst forth when the hostages were taken in 1979. But during the 1980s, did we act any better? No. What we did was we became allies of another thug who now became our current Hitler, and of course we've gotten rid of him, and that's Saddam Hussein. Well, so we join up with Saddam Hussein, and we say, let's have you go and invade Iran. And then we wonder why the Iranians are annoyed with us. And then we have a policy that totally backfires on us. We go in there and we don't understand 9/11. So instead of saying, we ought to come home, what we do is we go and invade two Muslim countries and occupy them. And in the process, by getting rid of the Taliban and Saddam Hussein, what we did, we strengthened Iran. But anybody who would have said that before, oh, no, we don't want to do that. We don't like the Iranians. We're going to get them, too. They're on the list as soon as we get rid of the Iraqis. Then we're going to go after the Iranians. But it is an obsession of empire building. And my contention is that empire building is not American. It's not constitutional. It's not moral. It costs us too much money. It costs us lives. It hurts our national defense. And it ruins our national security, and ultimately it undermines our personal liberties at home because of the atmosphere that we create, that we pass all these laws where we have military dictatorship declared here, get rid of habeas corpus, have warrantless searches, have national ID cards, and everybody's there begging for more safety by the government. The government's going to take care of us because they might attack us again, without asking the questions, why were we attacked? It's the policy. It's the policy of foreign intervention. Now, a lot of people will immediately challenge me and say, well, you sound like an isolationist. You want to just bring all the troops home, and you want to just stay at home and avoid being involved in the world. Not true at all. Matter of fact, I am the furthest thing from an isolationist. It's true, I'd bring the weapons home, I'd bring our troops home, but I do exactly what the founders advised, and that is foreign commerce, trade with countries, be friends with any country that's willing to be friends with, but stay out of their internal affairs, stay out of entangling alliances, and there's a much better chance that there would be peace in the world and that we would be stronger for it. And that's not isolationism. It means free trade, though. There's some challenges there on free trade because some who are in my camp that would like us to do a lot less militarily are more protectionist and they're more isolationist and they want to build fences and they don't want to trade and they want to, put on tariffs and all that. That's not the answer. It's not the answer. You want to have trade because trade is the way that a country prospers on free trade. At the same time, it means that we're less likely to fight with nations. But entangling alliances, I think, is a very important issue to deal with. I want to stay out of them, as we had been advised, because once again, I resent very much this idea that Congress transferred authority to the president for the president to go to war if he wanted to or didn't want to. You can't transfer a congressional authority to the executive branch through a majority vote in the Congress. And so that's unconstitutional. It shouldn't be done. But what about an entangling alliances? What about a commitment made by, if you're attacked, we're going to come to your rescue and we're going to fight your war for you? What right does one generation have to promise that the next generation will be on your doorstep with their guns and their lives and their money and sacrifice their life because a previous generation made that commitment? Not only is that morally wrong, it's not constitutional. You can't make a commitment like that in the future. What you can do is say that if somebody is attacked, it's come up on a debate. They say, what would you do if ABC happened, if somebody attacked country A? I said, well, I would talk to the Congress. If the Congress thought our national security was indeed being threatened and they thought a war had to be fought, then that's what would happen. But Congress won't do that. They wouldn't do it before. They don't want the responsibility of it. But it's the whole issue of entangling alliances, these commitments for the future that really doesn't make any sense. One of the things that bothers me a lot about the movement, the direction that we're going in, not only do I see this tremendous undermining of our personal liberties where we can't go anywhere without have camera on us, but the whole idea that we're supposed to feel safer because somebody at the airport makes us take our belt off and takes our toothpaste from us. They are literally, I was at an airport not too long ago, and I think this was in Nebraska, and even the airport officer there checking these bags. He says, it's so sad. He says, one thing in this town it was popular for was for a certain type of salad dressing. They made it there and people would take it home. He says, I have confiscated cases of this stuff. And he says, it doesn't make anybody safer. And here he's the guy that's forced to follow the law. And I get upset with and angry, and you do, but you should get angry at your congressman is the person you ought to get angry at for imposing those type of laws. But there, what I see coming, and this was once described by another individual in a different way about an Iron Curtain going around the Soviet Union. But we are devising an electronic curtain around our country. Not only are we hemmed in with our personal privacy and our personal lives, but in this country today, if you want to leave, you can't even leave this country without a passport. So why are they protecting us from terrorists by not allowing you to go where you please without a passport? You know, it doesn't make any sense at all. Not only that, if, a third of the people, believe it or not, a third of the people don't use checking accounts. They deal in cash. Noise the living daylights out of the government that they deal in cash. And if you happen to be in that category and you didn't have a passport and you saved up $10,000, $11,000, and you put it in your wallet, and you just walked across the border, you're in big trouble. You're going to be arrested, and you didn't have the proper passport to allow you to go out, and besides, you violated the laws about currencies, and who knows, you may be a drug dealer, you may be avoiding taxes, you couldn't possibly be a terrorist because you're an American, you're leaving the country. But our greatest danger today is what we're doing to ourselves, because we have lost our way on foreign policy as one item. This is also interconnected with something else that I've talked about a lot, and that has to do with monetary policy. If you want true free trade and friendship with countries, you have to have a sensible monetary unit. But today, we have a monetary unit that is controlled by the central banks of the world, that allows the politicians to spend money endlessly, allow the financial bubbles to build and then burst, and then, of course, the taxpayers there to pick up the pieces. But we have, and that is very destructive to international trade. You can't have good, sound international trade when you have fluctuating fiat currencies controlled by central banks in a secret backdoor room where one mentioned by one man in this country will be held, you know, they will, the financial markets will just hold to find out what word or two or three is said, because it can change the markets in hundreds of billions of dollars in one day. Oh, tomorrow I'm going to raise the interest rate. Oh, okay. I mean, this is so far from a free market economy. It's so far from what freedom is all about that it astounds me that the American people put up with this. But it is ultimately our personal liberties that we have to protect. Foreign policy is important. It's important because it is that part that protects our personal liberty the most. That once you have a war mentality, whether it's a war in Iraq, war against terrorism, war against drugs, war against who knows what, then the people, oh, there's a war going on, I have to sacrifice. Believe me, there is absolutely never a need to sacrifice one drop of freedom to protect our safety. Matter of fact, we will obviously be less safe. There's not a whole lot that we can change in a hurry, but there's a lot that we can do. But we have to put it into perspective. We have to decide whether we want to live in a free country and whether or not we want to live under the rule of law. We don't have a perfect constitution. We have a good constitution, probably the best ever written for a contract between the people and the government. But we have drifted from that. We ignore it under the war conditions, the welfare provisions, the monetary provisions. So it has no meaning for the Congress, no meaning for the courts, and no meaning for our presidents. And until we get the rule of law back and our goal being individual liberty, this country is going to be in worse shape on a daily basis. But there is no reason to believe that we can't restore those principles. There's a lot of people in this country who care, and I have met a lot of them in the last 6 months, and there are a lot more than I ever dreamed of. And they're very, very interested in saying, yes, I'm willing to assume the responsibility for myself in a free society. I want the government out of my pockets and out of my bedrooms and off my back. And I want to bring our troops home, and I want a sensible foreign policy, and I want a government that will protect us and protect our liberties. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, I'm going to ask one question, and then Andrew will ask a question, then we'll open it up to the floor. Just raise your hand and say your name and who you're with, if you're a student, if you're not a student, affiliation. Since today's 9/11, the anniversary of 9/11, I'd like to ask you what you mean. Do you really think the United States is in any way responsible for 9/11, as incredible as that sounds?
No, the people certainly aren't. Americans aren't responsible. Nobody in this room is responsible. I'm not responsible. But bad policy is a major participant in it. The ultimate moral responsibility falls on the people who committed the crime, the ultimate crime. Of course, they're all dead. So you have to understand suicide terrorism. But the American people aren't responsible. We have to understand there's a difference between the American people and our government and government policy. So if there's 12 people in our government who design our policy, and we're too complacent, or we're not told, or we're told or given the wrong information, and we go along with it, you're not responsible. The most responsibility would be maybe our lack of inclination to find out exactly what's going on. But in that way, the American people aren't responsible at all. But our policy is very important to understand why somebody took it upon themselves to want to do so much harm to us.
You don't think any of these terrorists would have done this if we hadn't been, we hadn't had troops in the Middle East?
I actually believe that if we had never been in the Middle East in the last 50 years, I do not believe we would have terrorism attack on us. I actually believe that to be the case.
You very eloquently outlined the unintended consequences of past foreign policy mistakes. But as president, unfortunately, you wouldn't be able to change history. You would have to either decide to deal with the unintended consequences or ignore them. So to take one example of a foreign policy challenge facing the U.S. right now, Iran openly states its ambition to become the dominant power in the Middle East. Its president has even talked about wiping Israel off the map. The Bush administration believes its pursuit of nuclear weapons is a grave threat that must be confronted. How would you respond to the perceived threat posed by Iran as president?
Probably a lot like we responded and treated the Soviets and the Chinese and the Pakistani and the Indians, Israel, everybody who has nukes are potentially, likely to have some of that information leak or transfer of weapons. And we do know that some of that has happened with Pakistan and others when this information may have filtered over into Korea. But to overblow the danger, I think, is the biggest problem that we have, because Iran, they don't have an air force. They don't have any intercontinental ballistic missiles. Our own CIAs don't agree entirely, but they know they don't have a missile. Right now, the UN is doing rather well. Baradei said that that they are cooperating, and they have no proof that they have ever diverted any nuclear material for bomb making. So there's absolutely no proof of this. And even if they did have one weapon, even if they had two weapons, maybe they're doing it for defensive purposes. Everybody else wants one, but why would it be a threat to Israel? You know, if we did less of controlling Israel, not allowing them to deal with their own borders, and not allowing them to have their own peace treaties with Syria and other countries, and we interfere with them, and we put the burden on Israel to make the decision, I'll tell you one thing, Iran, they might think us more reasonable. They might want us there. Israel has probably close to 300 nuclear bombs and nuclear missiles. They are quite capable of taking care of themselves. And this whole idea that if we don't stay over there, I think it's detrimental to Israel. I think our policies have hurt Israel tremendously. But there's no evidence they have the bomb, and I see no reason. They are more reasonable people than most of us realize. Matter of fact, the Iranian people, we ought to get to know the Iranian people. That's what we should be doing with a policy in our government, is talking to the people over there. And they like Americans. They like Americans, but Ahmadinejad does not speak for all these people. He's a loudmouth. He speaks for the politicians at home, just like a couple politicians here at home speak for the people, too. So I think the concern about Iran is way overblown, but it shouldn't be ignored. But once again, if we hadn't been involved in their internal affairs since 1953, we might be friends with them rather than the enemies. I can't see why many Iranians would like us after all that we have done. But everything that we have done has undermined the dissent that is a healthy dissent in Iran that would undermine Ahmadinejad, because we know that our CIA's over there trying to undermine that government. Can you imagine how we would feel as Republicans and Democrats and Libertarians and Independents if a foreign government came in over here? How did we feel on 9/11? Were we all together or not? That's what happens when we go over to Iran and we do that. We unify the country. That's exactly what's happened in Cuba. What we did, we put on sanctions on Cuba. And, of course, we've had Castro there for 40 years. The people would rally around the anti-American sentiment. It just backfires on us. And all we need to do is, I think, come up with a little bit of common sense, and the world would be a much better place for it.
Just quickly, because we want to open it to the floor, but to go back to the first part of my question about the unintended consequences, is it your broad principle that if you deal with the unintended consequences, you're liable to make the problem worse? So sometimes you have to simply let bad things happen, because if you intervene, you create more unintended consequences down the road. I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but is that broadly mm-hmm. your principle?
I know that that is the argument, but I don't accept the argument. To me, I see it in a medical term. If I make a wrong diagnosis and give the wrong treatment and I know the patient's not doing well, and I say, well, you know, I can't change my mind. It'll look like I made a mistake. And then I proceed and the patient dies. But this is what happens. We make a mistake and it's not working well, and we say, oh, it's going to be worse if we quit making the mistake. So I say, quit making the mistake. Yes, there could be some adjustments, but I predict it'll be less of a problem than everybody's predict. The people who make the predictions are the ones who said this would be a cakewalk. So why should we listen only to them? Why don't we listen to some of the people? And there was more than just myself. There were many, many generals and CIA people, and there's a lot of good students of foreign policy that made predictions before. Why don't we talk to them and find out what might happen? This whole idea that it would be an automatic coalition between the Shiites and Iran, there's no reason to accept that, because al-Sadr is a nationalist, and he doesn't want to be under the thumb of the Persians. I mean, we have to understand the region. But there's going to be a lot of fighting for a while. But matter of fact, in some of the places where a lot of the fighting has occurred in spite of our presence, the place is settling down because, you know, if al-Sadr was totally in charge of his area, they say we can't train enough of the Iraqis to do the job. Have anybody ever complained or heard a complaint that al-Sadr's troops aren't well trained? Nobody cares because they have a motivation. The Kurds, does anybody worry about them not being well trained? They have militias. No, they have a motivation. But those who work under our thumb are taking a lot of risk because they're going to be our puppets. They want to earn some money. They're infiltrating the army. They steal our weapons. It goes on and on. I cannot see how pursuing that would be of any benefit whatsoever. We need to just get out of there.
Okay. Somebody back in the back, right behind you.
Thank you for your words. My name is Fernando. I come from the Embassy of Mexico. My question is, I've seen a lack of debate in the U.S. presidential debates in what the U.S. policy should be to Latin America, especially to your neighbor and friend to the south, Mexico. What is your idea? In one question, you mentioned that the last time that Congress declared the war, if I understood correctly, was in the Second World War. How should we understand the authorization that Congress gave to the president to attack Hussein?
Let me see if I can rephrase that. What did we do to give the president the authority to do what he did?
Was it a declaration of war or not?
The original war.
The authorization to.
The war authorization, yes. Okay. The war authorization did come through the International Affairs Committee on which I sit. And it said for two major reasons, because our national security was threatened and because we needed the president the authority to have this power to enforce UN resolution, we wanted to transfer this power to the president and he could decide what he wanted. And I consider this an unconstitutional transfer of power. During that time, I wanted to make the point that this is improper way of doing things. And I said, look, if you, the committee, want to, go to war, do it properly and declare the war. So I'm introducing a substitute resolution that declares war up and down. It's only two or three lines, and the words were taken from World War II. Of course, I knew they weren't interested in that. They didn't want to assume the responsibility. For political reasons, they wanted to put all the burden on Bush. If it didn't go well, then the Democrats could blame Bush for the whole thing. And they didn't want this responsibility. And I had them vote on it, and they were furious because I made them record the vote. And, of course, nobody, voted to go to war. They said that that part of the Constitution was anachronistic. We didn't follow that part of the Constitution anymore. And besides, it was somebody else said, this was frivolous for me to bring this issue up. And far from that, I believe it is not frivolous to obey the law and obey the Constitution. And I think if we would have decided right then and there, we would have had to have the debate that's been going on now for the last year or two on, you know, why we're there and what we're going to do. Because if you declare war, it's serious stuff. Then you better know who the enemy is and what we're there for and what is the end point and how we're going to win it and what we're going to do. Because we didn't do that, it was all up in the air, and those 12 guys that were running the show said, oh, no sweat, and not only that, it won't even be a tax on the American people because we're going to get all the money from the oil. So.
Okay, down here. Question.
Welcome to SICE, Congressman Paul. My name is Chad Novacek. And being from Nebraska, I totally understand about the Dorothy Lynch salad dressing. So
okay. You knew more about it than I did.
I'm really glad that you're bringing up the notion of blowback to the American people, because it's a concept that's not really understood very well, even though you didn't really mention it by that name. Many of us think that we're involved in just the Civil War in Iraq, but since June of 1950, the United States has been in the middle of a civil war, the Chinese Civil War, between the Republic of China and the People's Republic of China, two legitimate Chinese governments. So, up until today, what do you think, if anything, should be a change in U.S. policy, speaking about U.S. intervention, about this issue? Thank you.
Well, I alluded to that when I talked about entangling alliances. And if you can back out of those alliances and those treaties, we should. And there's usually a clause in there that allows you to vacate a treaty. So it is assumed by most Americans that if that civil war breaks out into a hot war between nationalist China and communist China, at least old communist China. It's rather ironic to call it communist China because they're our bankers now. You know, it sounds to me like they've become pretty capitalistic lately with this less interventionist foreign policy. So I would want to back away from it. I do not want to commit you or your kids and your money and all to say that if that war breaks out, that we're going to send it in there to settle that dispute. Matter of fact, things are going well over there. The Taiwanese have invested a lot of money in mainland China. And they have every reason in the world not to be involved. I think if we weren't in Korea, I think it would be unified. Because the South Koreans want to do more. They want to travel. And every time they hint that they want to deal with the North Koreans, oh, no, we're in charge here. You're not allowed to do that. I think the same thing would be there. I think it would be, I'm not going to predict it be unified, but I don't think they'd be, if they knew we weren't going to be there, I think there would be more motivation for the Taiwanese to work something out. And I don't think the Chinese are about ready to you know, unleash an attack on them because of the financial reason. That's why trade and commerce is so great. You know, the last time we had I think one of our spy planes was forced off and forced to land, and it was an international incident with the Chinese. It was a non-incident. You know, and during the Cold War period, that would have been major. But both sides probably look back and say, hey, we have too much invested here. We're going to make a big deal, and it'll be, you know, in a week or so that the whole thing was settled. So that's why I think trade is the issue. But future commitment of another generation, money and kids to fight a war, I just totally reject it.
Congressman Paul, certainly there are occasions where there are threats to the U.S. from outside of our borders, but they are initiated not by government entities whom we can declare war against. Could you please elaborate on perhaps the guidance from our founding fathers and your own strategy on how your strategy would play out in a situation where we had a problem, we had a threat outside our borders, but there was not a government, so we could not, you know, literally declare war.
Right. And if we know exactly where those individuals are, I believe we have the right to attack. I did vote for the authority for Afghanistan and to go after the Al-Qaeda, but Of course, my position now is that hasn't gone well. We've done exactly the wrong thing. We went into occupation, and we forgot about Osama bin Laden. But I've reintroduced the notion of what the founders talked about, and that is to issue a letter of mark and reprisal. I think someday I'm going to call this the Ross Perot principle, because I always bring Ross Perot up when I'm trying to demonstrate mark and reprisal. Remember when Ross Perot had his troops taken, or his employees taken hostage in Iran, and he decided that he was not going to beg and plead the United States government to deal with it. It was his problem. So he hired some ex-military special agents, and he went over there, took them over there, and rescued them, brought them home, and nobody died. So that's pretty good. And, of course, our administration back in the 70s tried to do the same thing and didn't do it very well. We didn't get our hostages, and we lost some more of our men. This principle of letter and mark and reprisal is something that the founders introduced and used in our early history. They used it mainly to go after pirates. But it's almost like deputizing somebody. And you get a letter and you become official. You're not breaking the law. And it was accepted internationally that if you had a letter of mark and reprisal, you were acting within the law. And you couldn't go out and start robbing and killing. You had to act within the law. But you had the authority to go and capture the bad guys. And you could do this with Osama bin Laden. If it hadn't been done immediately, because there was a lot more information, there could have been some special unit. Just think if it would have worked, if they had been thinking about that. Although I introduced that within a week or two of 9/11. But just think if we'd have done that and said, you bring Osama bin Laden back and we'll try him and we'll take care of him, we'll give you $1 billion. We'd have saved $499 billion by now.
Good morning. My name is Sarah Afshar. As a student concentrating in Middle East studies, I'm dying to ask you an international affairs question. But actually, as a former Marine Corps officer, I have a question for you on leadership. You mentioned earlier the issue of using fear to unify a nation, and that has been a major concern for me over the past several years. How do you think you'll be able to unify within the United States as president, both within between policymakers, Congress, the American people, to actually move forward?
Okay, I think I need a little. I didn't hear all the words. So how would I handle the problem of moving away from an empire?
Basically, no. To unify the American people.
Oh, bringing the people to agree to this.
Unify policymakers and to move forward, not using kind of fear to unify, but a proactive kind of approach.
That really is the challenge, because give me the benefit of the doubt that I have the right answer, but it doesn't mean anything if there isn't a consensus. If there's no consensus, these ideas won't work. So the American people have to endorse it, agree with it, and understand it. The members of Congress would have to, and that would depend on an individual who would have to convince them that it's in our best interest to do so. And that would be the big challenge. I think my reluctance to enter this race was that not too many people would be interested in what I'm talking about. The fact that there's a lot more people than I ever dreamed of means that there's a fertile field out there. And it's growing by leaps and bounds, because a lot of people hadn't heard this, and they'll say, yeah, I had never heard of mark and reprisal. How do you spell that? And so they're getting interested, and I think that when they realize it's in their self-interest, they will join us. And I believe this is an issue that you can bring right and left together. Our group coming together are not just Republicans. There's a certain amount of Republicans. I wish there were more. But there's a lot of independents. There's a lot of Democrats. And there's a lot of people who have never been anything, because it makes a whole lot of sense. So I think that we can bring people together. In Congress, there's the element of the old right, which I sort of come from, that we're opposed to the war and are strongly opposed to the war now. But there's a lot on the left that I work with very closely. But my biggest challenge is to revitalize the interest of the conservatives to feel comfortable that they don't have to be warmongers. you know, in order to be conservatives. Conservatives used to be like old Senator Robert Taft, didn't even want to be in NATO. You know, he didn't want entangling alliances. He knew the history. He knew the founders. So there's a strong, strong principles found in the old right tradition that come together with the left position currently. So things get shifted. And I think it's very dangerous for a politician to talk about Democrats are left-wingers and Republicans are conservatives. We have to deal with the issues. And I can't totally answer your question other than the fact that I think this on this issue, with an individual fully explaining this, people will realize it's in their best interest, because I am so convinced that if our goal in life is to have peace and prosperity, this is the way the goal go. And if you have to reject the control by the special interests, the military-industrial complex, and all those other interests that say we have to be over there to spread democracy and all those things, I think when they hear that information, I don't think it's very hard to bring the majority together on it.
You spoke very poignantly of the invasion of Iraq in 2003 as kind of a watershed event in our foreign policy, with perhaps unenvisionable consequences for generations. Can you speak to the invasion of spring of 1999 in Serbia as perhaps the real watershed as far as an unprovoked, premeditated invasion of a sovereign country that we recognize as being an independent country? And what are the consequences? And how do those two, are those two twins?
I think so. They're close. I think this one was a little bit more deliberate with full knowledge, invasion and occupation. But you're right. I think in principle, they're very, very close. But there was a war going on there, and we picked sides and we went in. But you could argue, you know, Truman might have been the real instigator, because he went in, you know, under a UN resolution, and there was no really big discussion at the time. But you could use 1953, or you could use all the times of what we've done secretly with our CIA. A lot of those contribute. I use the invasion mainly because it was so deliberate and so confrontational, in that preemptive war is good. It's morally right. It's necessary. And we have this obligation to invade countries and occupy them. And it was a little different than Serbia, because there was, you know, the factions going on. It was probably closer to the factions going on in Korea and Vietnam. But I think all of them are part of it. But I think you make a point that we shouldn't have ignored that as well. The interesting thing about the point you're making is, guess how many Republicans in the Congress endorsed that bombing? Very, very few. Boy, it was a Clinton war, and that was evil. But now, of course, the Bush war is holy, you know, and we all have to support it. So that is a bit annoying at times, too.
Anybody else back there?
Yes, thank you. Robert Capozzi, freeliberal.com. Congressman, I'm a long-term admirer of yours, but I'd like a little clarity on two points that you've been making today and during the campaign. The first is the notion that the Constitution doesn't, apparently that these entangling alliances are unconstitutional, and I think we're conflating what, perhaps I'm getting the sense you're conflating the notion of what the founders said and what the Constitution actually says, which allows for treaties. My second point is, what specifically would you do now that all that has happened in Iran and Afghanistan? Would you, if you were elected president, what would you do, for instance, for the hunt for Osama? Would you pick it up, or would you? Do you feel that too much damage has been done? Thank you.
I would, okay, first on the entangling alliances, we're allowed to have alliances, we're allowed to have treaties. And treaties, according to the Constitution, are the law of the land. So if we have a treaty with Canada dealing with a border, you know, it becomes the law of the land, you know, and that settles the dispute because a treaty is signed. But a treaty cannot be used to amend the Constitution. It was never intended. That's where my limitation is. If it implies or amends the Constitution for a commitment to war, you can't go to war with a treaty. That is my point. But I guess entangling is, to me, it's probably when you're committing to war. An ordinary treaty, settling international law and disputes or cooperation of one sort, then that to me would be a little bit different. But as far as going after Osama bin Laden, I would like to get the Congress interested in market reprisal, because I think they missed their chance at Tora Bora for us to do it in an ordinary fashion. And why that happened, nobody talks about why did you blow it? Because they were so close, they knew where he was, he was on the run. They said, oh, well, we'll turn it over to the Northern Alliance and the Pakistanis, they'll take care of it. But if the Pakistanis say, stay out of our country, I think that I'd want to respect that right now. But if we were going to try the compromise between those two and these neither extreme, I think the letter of mark and reprisal would fit the bill.
Congressman Paul, my name is Eric Clark. You mentioned something. Thank you. You had mentioned very briefly the central banks around the world. And I'm curious if you could elaborate on our central bank, the Federal Reserve Bank, and its impact on American foreign policy.
Well, that is interesting because there is a connection. I went to the Congress first time around in the 70s because I became fascinated with monetary policy and the breakdown of the Bretton Woods and how central banks bring on the booms and the busts and the depressions and the inflations, and that's what I've been interested in. As time went on, I became more interested and fascinated with foreign policy, and there is a connection. The connection is somewhat indirect, though. Central banking, that vehicle whereby governments are privileged to create money out of thin air, is the encouragement for governments to act irresponsibly. Because if we as a people had to be taxed for everything that we get immediately, we'd rebel. That's one reason why I suggested what we do is get rid of the withholding tax and everybody write a check every week to the government, and people would be so outraged that they would end it. But nevertheless, everything is sneaky. So we tax a lot and the people get annoyed, so we don't raise taxes. We say, oh, we're going to lower taxes, so everybody's for lowering taxes, which is good. And then we have to borrow a lot, and we do that, but then there's a limit to the borrowing. But then they resort to creating money out of thin air, monetizing debt, create a treasury bill, and the Federal Reserve ends up buying it. And how do they buy it? They buy it with money out of thin air. So that's inflationary. That dilutes the value of the dollar. So we literally can finance a war through inflation. Countries have done this for thousands of years. They have literally undermined the value of the currency. In the old days, it was diluting the metal or clipping coins or doing whatnot. Even in early China history, they had paper currency. But tyrants and empires always destroy their money. And they can't, and they do it in a more sophisticated manner now than ever before. And they're shrewder. I mean, they get away with it. They prop it up, and they talk to each other, and they might prop up our consumers, and the Chinese might buy our Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac securities. But what it does, it allows the politicians to get into wars and into the welfare system, and they'll act responsibly because the Fed will take care of it. The Fed will create this money, and nobody now we're having a serious crisis on the financial market, but nobody's ever going to say, well, that's part of the reason why we're financing this war through inflation. This is exactly what happened after the 60s, what motivated me in the 70s, because we had, back then it was guns and butter. What are we doing now? It's guns and all these new entitlement programs. Boy, thank goodness we don't have those liberals in charge like we used to. But here the conservatives up there increasing all these entitlement programs, depending on the Fed. So ultimately, governments depend on inflation, that is the creation of new money out of thin air to finance war, and very, very destructive eventually to the economy.
We have time for a couple more questions back there.
Thank you for being here and speaking with us, Congressman Paul. My name is Amy Gilley. I'm very concerned about our borders, and I wonder, where do you stand on securing our borders, and what would you do about the thousands of illegal immigrants that are currently here in the country? Thank you.
I thought I wouldn't get any tough questions today. So, no, I'm for stronger borders. I don't want the border guards in Iraq, where some of them are right now. I want them on our borders. We should have more border guards. We should have more security. I think citizenship is too much of a gift. Birthright citizenship and amnesty, I'm not in support of that. I am not a fan of fences and guns and threats to keep people out. But I see that it is the subsidization of illegal immigrants that counts. The promise of citizenship in an easy way by averting the law, I think, is an inducement, as well as free education and free medical care that are mandates. Our hospitals are being closed in Texas because they can't afford it, and there's mandates on it. And in some hospitals, 75% are deliveries of illegal aliens. And it's because of the system. But ultimately, what I'm really interested in is getting rid of the welfare state. Because the welfare state encourages some of our workers, believe it or not to work, and then jobs go begging and people come over and they take the job. If we had a true free market economy, if we had a sound economy, we weren't wasting these $1 trillion a year and overseas messing around, this country would be so prosperous, the immigration issue would be, it would be a non-event, totally. There would be a need for workers, and they could come. There would be a workers program, and it would enhance our economy. Right now, today, what we have devised is a system where the illegal immigrants and immigrants are becoming the scapegoat, unnecessarily so. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't ignore it, but that's the real reason. One more.
One more, quiet, right here.
Hi, my name is David Befford, and I'm a student here. First off, just quickly about, illegal immigrants don't actually get benefits from the federal government, and so if there's resentment, it's a misperception on the part of the American people, not because they actually get benefits. But I'm wondering about you're advocating the gold standard then, is that correct?
Well, first thing is I'm advocating the Constitution, which says only gold and silver can be legal tender.
Okay, so essentially a gold standard like system. I mean, aren't you then giving away, useful tools to sort of adjusting the economy just so that you can have this sort of idea of virtue that the government won't, spend too much or it won't be able to use inflation? I mean, I think that that's really kind of irresponsible, actually, because you're giving up sovereignty for something that's also arbitrary. And I mean, I just don't see why you can't live with 2-3% inflation a year.
Well, that is the Milton Friedman approach. You mean you're talking about 2-3% increase in the money supply per year?
Inflation.
Okay, how do you measure inflation? By prices or by monetary supply? See, pardon me?
Prices.
See, okay. To me, the definition of inflation is increase in the supply of money, because that is the distortion. It wrecks the economy because it gives you false information about what interest rates are. They give you lower interest rates than they should be, and then we have all the ramifications of malinvestment that comes from this. Now, yes, 2-3% inflation, let's say the Milton Friedman advocated increase the money supply by 3% and we can live with it. And then, prices are going to go up 3%, your wages are going to go up 3%, and your cost of living is going up 3%. Doesn't happen that way. Inflation causes a maldistribution of the price increases. Poor people in the middle class have higher inflation rates than Wall Street. Wall Street benefits by it because they get all the money and they do these buyouts and all these deals that they make, and they make billions, and they get the money, use the money first. The money circulates. The poor people now end up with an inflation rate of 15% because of their medical care costs up, education costs are higher, and they end up suffering a lot more. So if it were equal, if everybody's prices would go up at 3% and the money supply went up 3%, of course, there'd be no need to increase the money supply because under a gold standard, the money supply goes up about 3% anyway. And that would be quite adequate. But once you get involved, even if you tried to regulate it at 3%, you would have to have full trust and faith and confidence in this authority of the government to live how they promised to live. But politicians tend to spend too much, and then they'll go to 4%. Oh, we better go to 4%, and then they will abuse it. So the true gold standard means that you as an individual can always check it out. You would not have gold circulating, but if you had credits or certificates, if you're not trusting the government, if you think the government's printing too many certificates, you can always go to the bank and say, I want to see something of real value. That holds the government in check. But I don't, my position isn't closing down the Fed in one day and is not going back to the gold standard. My position is just legalize the Constitution. Let gold and silver circulate as legal tender. Get rid of all the taxes, the sales taxes and the capital gains taxes. Make sure you can settle your disputes in ounces of gold rather than in Federal Reserve notes. And if you like Federal Reserve notes and like the inflation and don't think it's too bad, you can deal with it. But if somebody else wants, doesn't want to buy a 30-year bond, figuring that, yeah, my kids are going to go to college, I'm going to buy a 30-year bond, and this is going to be perfect, and I'll have purchasing power, the cost of education won't go up, and the value of the money is going up, and boy, I'm going to be well off. Or you might go to a savings account and buy a bond in gold. And you might only make 1% or 2%, but it just might be that gold might keep up with the cost of living. You know, the cost of education may be going up at 10%. The gold is going to go up. So all I want to do is legalize competition in currencies, because it would be disruptive in the monetary field just to close down the Fed. But eventually, that would be the goal. Thank you very much.